The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Technically, it is a district work period that they're in right now, but others would call it recess. They'll return to the Capitol next week. And when they do so, the House could, in pretty short order, potentially be facing down a vote on Ukraine aid. At least that's the signal from House Speaker Mike Johnson, who was talking on Fox last night about the idea, as well as what that could actually look like. Some suggestions of the aid coming in the form of a loan, potentially money from frozen Russian assets being put toward Ukraine. The question is, can it go anywhere? And can he keep the speaker's gavel if he moves forward with this? Joining us now is Kate Ackley, who reports on Congress for Bloomberg Government. So, Kate, first, just walk us through what exactly it seems that Johnson is propositioning here when it comes to Ukraine aid, keeping in mind we haven't seen an actual plan on paper or any kind of legislative text.
Right. Well, you hit the exact points that he made last night in that interview. I think he called them sort of innovations, that he might look at some, innovations to move this measure. I mean, I think we're still in a lot of the same, with a lot of the same options as we were a couple of weeks ago. You remember at the beginning of, we call it a recess, at the beginning of just to kick off the recess, Marjorie Taylor Greene, entered that potential sort of motion to vacate the chair, which, is nothing happening with that right now, but it's that sort of threat that looms over Speaker Mike Johnson as he looks through these options. I think he's basically right now been trying to set expectations. He's been talking about that he is dealing with a historically sort of low number majority, that he doesn't have a lot of options, but some of them still include, where we could see a discharge petition where you see a majority from, including Democrats trying to move the Senate bill. That's still out there. But Mike Johnson, Speaker Johnson's been talking about adding some innovations to this this piece of legislation. Like you said, using maybe funding the Ukraine aid with money that's been seized from Russian oligarchs, one of the ideas that he has floated. So we'll be watching that as he sort of looks at that over the next few days.
Well, Kate, I'm glad you brought up as well the fact that there is a motion to vacate hanging over his head. He did say in that interview last night that he's been texting with Marjorie Taylor Greene, referred to her at one point as a friend, said they're going to talk next week. Is the fact that he is out there vocally talking about Ukraine aid, which is what she said would be the triggering effect, essentially, that vote is what would actually bring the motion to vacate forward into that privilege resolution potentially. Is he calling her bluff, or does he think if it's Ukraine aid he is offering, that Democrats are going to be willing to step up and save him?
Well, I think both of those things, could be that could be going on. He thinks that Democrats might be there to save him. He's also tried to say, with this, like he's called it a historically low majority for House Republicans. He's really tried to message that if the more they kind of put their divisions on display, the worse they are off in terms of negotiating with Democrats on this and other things. So he's certainly trying to bring that message that, they should be unified, which they have not been, and the things that are on the horizon, Ukraine aid, but other things like the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, reauthorization. These are things that divide Republicans that are on the agenda ahead. So you know, yes, he said he was texting with Marjorie Taylor Greene. She also said the day that she, you know, entered that motion to vacate, or, you know, threw that out there, basically, to have that hanging over his head, that it wasn't personal, that she, you know, likes Speaker Johnson personally, but she's unhappy with the policies. He too said in his own messaging, you know, that he doesn't like some of the policies that Republicans have agreed to, but that they don't have a lot in their own hand because they have this mm-hmm. tiny majority in the House. They don't hold the Senate, and their party doesn't hold the White House. So he's kind of saying, right. what do you expect me to be able to do? He has said that he's looking to November. He's fundraising this week. You know, he's starting off not with the level of fundraising that his predecessor, Kevin McCarthy, had, just a huge fundraising network. So he's been working to build up his fundraising network. And he's saying, you know, Republicans need to grow the majority in the House, which is a tall, tall order.
All right. Kate Ackley of Bloomberg Government. Great reporting. Thank you so much for joining us on Bloomberg Television and Radio. Of course, as we debate the future over aid for Ukraine, it's worth noting that in that supplemental package that did pass the Senate, it wasn't just aid for Ukraine, but also Taiwan and Israel. And on the subject of Israel, we have much to discuss there. As the war in Hamas is still ongoing, approaching the six-month mark, and we heard from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a news conference yesterday saying he plans to have the military move 1 million Palestinian civilians out of the southern city of Rafah in Gaza and then move in to attack the remaining Hamas battalions in that city. This, of course, as he was also facing tens of thousands of protesters in Israel calling for a change in government. Joining us now is an expert on the subject of Israel. Aaron David Miller is with us, fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. It's always great to have you here on Bloomberg TV and radio. First of all, how hard will it be to Netanyahu actually accomplish what he says he is going to, moving 1 million people safely out of Rafah, getting them aid, and then going in to finish the job of eradicating Hamas? Can this actually be done credibly?
You know, I have no doubt that the Israelis can eliminate, at least as an organized military presence, Hamas's remaining battalions in Rafah. The idea of moving 1.34 million people, if the Israelis had 3 months, the Israelis were tightly coordinating both with the United States and international aid organizations. If the Israelis, together with its organizations, could create sanctuaries where, in fact, Palestinians would have access to potable water, to shelter, to sanitation, medical facilities, you could imagine that it would be possible. Under these circumstances, with pressure mounting, particularly with respect to releasing the hostages, and the Israelis persuaded that only by going into Rafah will Hamas be persuaded to cut any sort of deal to release hostages, seems highly unlikely. But I think the only saving grace here, frankly, is that we are weeks, perhaps even more, weeks away, not until May, I would imagine, with the Israelis mount such an operation. And today, even as we speak, two senior members of Mr. Netanyahu's mm-hmm. government have been talking virtually with Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, and other administration officials. This was the much-delayed ballyhooed visit that was supposed to take place last week, canceled as a consequence of the American abstention on the UN Security Council resolution by the prime minister. But those conversations took place today. I suspect they'll be ongoing because the administration, understandable, I suspect, has real concerns about whether or not the Israelis can do what they need to do in Rafah without endangering hundreds of thousands of Palestinians.
So maybe there is the opportunity for the U.S. to express those views, to provide suggestions, as they have said they will, for alternatives to how the operation in Rafah could be handled. But it's still the remaining question is whether or not the Israelis are hearing that message, whether they're giving much credence at all to whatever the U.S. has to say.
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. The other interceding development, of course, could be an agreement. Negotiators are now in mm-hmm. Qatar. Israelis, Egyptians, Qataris, Americans, to try to broker a limited exchange, hostages for Palestinian prisoners, and a temporary ceasefire for 6 weeks. That might actually create a situation where you could break the battlefield dynamic. But again, Mr. Netanyahu has said so many times that they've got to do Rafah, quote unquote, do Rafah. Israeli public, including the war cabinet, Benny Gantz, who is the putative successor, if you believe the polls, and I do, should elections be held today or even 3 months from now, Netanyahu would not be able to put together a government. But the vast majority of the Israeli public is still very much supportive, not of Netanyahu, but of his war aims.
Well, and of course, we saw the Israeli public, or at least tens of thousands of members of the Israeli public, out over the weekend protesting, calling for new elections. And I just wonder to what extent you think that domestic pressure would actually change the behavior of Bibi Netanyahu, knowing there also was great pressure and a long period of protest over the judicial reform that he was trying to push through. And it took a long time for that actually to turn into changes in those proposals. What influence, if any, do those protesters have?
You know, I'm glad you referred to the mass protests in a country of nearly 10 million people, hundreds of thousands of people out in the streets, 40 plus weeks in a row. I'm wondering, frankly, whether or not on any issue we would be capable of doing something quite like that. But it stalled the judicial reform. It prevented Netanyahu from acting. And I think mass public opinion and demonstrations is now the new force in Israeli politics. The problem is there's no mechanism right now to topple this Israeli government. If there aren't defections from Mr. Netanyahu's coalition, and they probably won't be, there's no way to call for new elections. And the notion of a constructive vote of no confidence, where the parties would identify a ministerial candidate that got more than 60 plus one votes, that could create a new government without elections, that's almost impossible. And Benjamin Netanyahu on trial for bribery, fraud, breach of trust is not going to resign. So I think right now there's no mechanism to remove him. I think if this war downshifts, then I think the issue of accounting and accountability will come to the fore. And it strikes me as almost impossible to imagine that a prime minister who's presided over the worst terror attack in the history of the state of Israel, the bloodiest day for Jews since the Nazi Holocaust, is going to be able to survive. Every poll suggests he can't and won't.
Mm. Meantime, we're still getting fresh news out of the weekend, Aaron, and we want to be careful with this, as this is just reporting from Iranian and Syrian state media, but they are reporting today that an Israeli airstrike on Iran's embassy compound in Syria has killed a number of people, including a top military commander, Mohammad Reza Zahedi, a high-ranking Iranian general who had been linked to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Is that a major escalation in this conflict when we're talking about strikes in Syria against Iranians, keeping in mind that it hasn't just been Israel versus Hamas, but other Iranian proxies active in this region as well since October 7th?
Add to that the fact that the Israelis struck in December and killed a top IRGC commander. Reza Zahedi, though, I think it was even more senior than the one they killed last year. If you told me that 6 months into this war, what you have is a mini confrontation every single day between Hezbollah and Israelis along the Israeli-Lebanese border, that we wouldn't have had a major escalation, I wouldn't have believed you. Although Hezbollah and Israel and the Iranians have been operating under a kind of escalatory threshold, simply unwilling to take the kinds of steps that could trigger a major escalation. We talk about major escalation. We're talking about an Israeli-Hezbollah war, which in 06, summer of 06, shut down the northern half of the Middle East's most preeminent military power, Israel. This time around, Hezbollah's got between 150,000 and 200,000 high-trajectory weapons of various ranges, lethalities, and precision. You don't want to go there because you could easily, in that situation, morph into strikes by the U.S. and or Israel on Iranian territory, Iran's retaliation with ballistic missiles. Then you'd see something the Middle East has never experienced before, which is a major regional war. I don't think you're going to get there, but certainly the Israelis have not claimed responsibility for this. But that's this sort of escalation could, in fact, trigger an escalatory cycle. Hopefully it won't.
Well, and while we're considering other forces in the Middle East and just our remaining minute here with you, over the weekend as well, we did get news out of Turkey. The party of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan suffering an unprecedented defeat in municipal elections. Just how consequential is what's happening in Turkey for the balance in the wider Middle East?
Yeah, I'm not sure it has much of an impact yet, at least in the broader Middle East. I think it does have consequences for Erdogan, who is from Istanbul, served as mayor. He considers it a major stronghold. The fact that one of his key opponents actually bested him by a significant number of votes doesn't augur well for his legacy or perhaps for the policies that he wants to continue to push for internally in Turkey. So again, I'm not sure you're talking about a major regional consequence, but certainly for internal Turkish politics, very significant.
All right, so maybe some domestic pressures in Turkey as well as in Israel against their respective leaders. Aaron David Miller, always great to have you here on Bloomberg TV and radio. Thank you so much for joining us. He, of course, is senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We'll have much more coming up on Balance of Power. We have to talk to our signature political panel, Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano. They'll be with us on the other side of this break. This is Bloomberg.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Welcome back indeed to Washington, where we are broadcasting to you live on Bloomberg Television and Radio. I'm here. Joe Matthew is taking a well-deserved day off, and Congress is taking the day off today as well. Actually, the rest of this week, they're still on recess or the district work period, whatever you want to call it, but they might have some work to do when they return, specifically on aid for Ukraine. We heard from House Speaker Mike Johnson on a Fox News interview last night talking about potentially a path forward for a vote this month, in the month of April. But he's floating some ideas of what form it could take, including potentially being a loan or taking frozen Russian assets, which could be complicated and need Europe involved, and using that to pay for Ukraine's war effort. So with more, let's bring in now our signature political panel, Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano. So it seems, Jeannie, that he is looking at putting this on the floor despite the threats to his speakership that might result from Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has already filed but not acted upon a motion to vacate. There is the question, though, before we get to his future, about what future, if any, these ideas would actually have, considering they don't need to just pass the House, but a Democratic-controlled Senate as well, and be passed by a Democratic president. Could we see Democrats sign on to this idea of it being a loan rather than direct aid or of using Russian assets to pay for Ukraine's efforts?
Yeah, you know, it was a fascinating interview because he was like park coach. He kept using these sort of footballish metaphors about Hail Marys and yards and dust and all these things that I don't know about. And then he also was like being a little bit professorial and trying to, you know, explain to the viewers that he only has a one vote margin. He can't get everything he wants. You know, we have to be incremental. So it was a fascinating interview. You could really feel the challenge that he has in front of him. You know, the Democrats to these three ideas that he has been floating have been, you know, cold to the idea of a loan, which Donald Trump raised. I wouldn't say it's off this table by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, this is the challenge with all of these ideas. He's got to make sure he keeps the Democrats on board and, of course, brings his conservative, as many as he needs, element together. I think it's doable. I think they will get it done. The LNG idea is one that's, you know, creative, a little bit Pelosian, some people are saying, trying to trade there like an old-fashioned legislator. So, you know, I felt like 5 months in, you know, Johnson is really getting his legislative feet under him and really pushing, and sounds like an old-fashioned legislator here.
Well, we're 5 months into his speakership, and as these 5 months have progressed, Rick, the majority that he's dealing with has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller, and will get even more so on April 19th when Mike Gallagher, the current chair of the China Select Committee, retires early. So this speaks to the one vote margin he was talking about last night. And it also speaks to the idea that he can't afford to lose many votes if a motion to vacate vote actually was forced by Marjorie Taylor Greene. There wouldn't be that many people that would need to join her to kick him out of a job. It raises the question of whether she's just bluffing or if he's deciding he's just going to call it and hope Democrats step in.
Yeah, Kaylee, I mean, you called it right. I mean, here's a guy with basically a functioning one vote majority today. Because Mike Gallagher isn't going to do him any favors in showing up when he wants him, even between now and the 19th. And then on top of that, you've got all these added conflicts within the caucus, including Marjorie Taylor Greene's sort of threat to depose the chair. Nobody wants a speaker's election between now and November. We've got enough problems in the House of Representatives not to go through the charade of trying to pick another leader at this point in time, especially with all the political pitfalls that fall in front. Jeannie's right. He is up to wanting to try and take a vote on Ukraine now. It's taken him a while. We've had that Senate bill pass for over a month now, and nobody in the House has acted upon it. And that is the prescription for getting something done. The idea that you're going to give a loan to the Ukraine so they can then give that money back to the United States industrial establishment to produce the guns and missiles that they need is crazy. The idea here is that we are funding our capacity to build here in this country, which is sorely needed, and we don't need Ukraine in the middle of that transaction. They default. Who's going to go back and get the money from the various weapons manufacturers in the United States? Sorry, it doesn't work. I love the idea of using repo to use Russian dollars to fund a war machine against them. The downside is you got to go get that money. It's in the form of assets in banks and luxury yachts and houses. When is that going to get done in time to, you know, continue the war, or in time to sort of, you know, build a Ukraine after the fact? So none of these ideas are particularly keen on anybody who really watches the Ukraine movement. But at least he's talking about a vote. And if there's a vote, there can be amendments. And if there are amendments, then you get a bill that could potentially work.
Yeah, Rick, to your point about seizing those frozen, or I guess assets that already have been seized, but then deploying them in Ukraine's favor, it's worth noting a lot of those billions of dollars in assets are not held or controlled by the U.S. A lot of that is Europe. So essentially what you're saying is that's a lot harder to actually make reality, even if the principle seems like it could work in theory.
That's right. These guys have kicked the can in the house. A lot of people losing their lives in Ukraine because of it. And they need to get really serious about this war. It's a particularly important war to Europe and to the United States. Ukraine's shedding the blood, and we need to shed some treasure. And together we can actually have an impact there. And I think the heat is going to go on the House of Representatives and Speaker Johnson when they return after a two-week absence where they are out talking to constituents rather than helping the people of the Ukraine. But look, I get it. The schedule's the schedule. It's the only thing that actually happens in Washington is vacation. And so the reality is here, he's going to come under intense scrutiny to get a bill passed, and a bill passed quick.
Well, we know that getting funding bills in particular passed has proven very difficult. It took us almost half of the entire fiscal year to get appropriation bills across the floor just last month. And as we're seeing pan out with Ukraine, supplemental requests don't necessarily move quickly either. But we're potentially going to see another coming from the White House in the billions of dollars, Jeannie, related to rebuilding the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore. We got news from the White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre just within the last hour that President Biden will be making a trip to Baltimore, visiting the location of the bridge collapse on Friday. When Congress returns, do you expect that they will deal with this in short order, or could we too see some politicking around emergency aid in this instance?
We always see politicking, so I wouldn't put that out. I would hope they take this up, you know, upwards of $1 billion to respond to this. And I think, you know, the thing to you hope all members of Congress keep in mind is that unfortunately, almost all of their districts and states will be impacted by an emergency and need the support of emergency funds from the federal government. So they should be supportive of this one because unfortunately it will be them next. So they will take this up. It is good the president is visiting. But again, with this Republican caucus and the one vote margin, it's awfully difficult to know if you see Johnson working with Democrats or Democrats helping get something like this over the line. Does it again cause him to be worried about his speakership? That is, you know, the way in which he has had to operate for 5 months, and I don't suspect it's going to get any better after Easter break.
Well, and Jeannie, counting on Democratic votes also raises the question if Democrats will vote for everything. We already discussed whether they'd get on board with some of these ideas around Ukraine, but also on Israel. We know that Democrats, specifically more progressive Democrats, have been resistant to the idea of continuing to provide funding for Israel without actual conditions around that aid, considering what we're seeing happening to Palestinian life in Gaza. On that note, we did just get some headlines out of the spokesman for the State Department, Matt Miller, who says that the virtual talk with Israel on the subject of Rafah, that southern Gaza city with more than a million Palestinians taking refuge there, is now underway at the White House. And the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is among those participants. Rick, just in our final minute here, do you expect much headway will be made in these talks today? Is Israel really listening to the U.S.? Even if they're deciding to hear them out, are they really hearing them?
Yeah, I think there's been progress made with Bibi's administration and the Israeli army over their conduct in Gaza. And they've hesitated on the full engagement in Rafah until at which point in time they could have these conversations with the United States. So I'm hopeful that they can change their tactics to the point where you still have an effective military response to clean out Hamas, but at the same time, minimize civilian casualties. It's always a moving target, but we're hopeful that these conversations will produce that result.
And Jeannie, finally, are these conversations, knowing that the U.S. is changing their messaging toward Israel, President Biden being quite public about that, enough to actually change the mind of voters who might be reluctant to cast a vote for him in November because of his stance in being supportive of Israel?
You know, I haven't seen evidence of that on the ground. The protests have been, you know, continual. They have been focused on the president and the administration and the Democrats. I think those will likely continue. And I think we may have the first presidential election in a while in which a foreign policy issue like this plays larger than usual. And the Biden team knows that, hence these conversations that they're having.
All right, Jeannie Shanzano and Rick Davis, our signature political panel kicking us off on this Monday. Thank you so much.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Now, we know that when the Fed is looking at inflationary forces, they like to look at core. They X out food and they X out energy because those are more volatile inputs. But that's not to say that the American voter isn't very cognizant of energy prices, specifically prices at the pump, which right now on average, according to AAA, are at $3.53 a gallon, continuing really the steady climb we have seen since the start of the year. So for more on gas prices and what exactly is happening, we are joined now by Patrick DeHaan. He is Gas Buddy's head of petroleum analysis. Patrick, great to have you back here on Bloomberg Television and Radio. When you look at really what has been just a consistent upward trajectory in prices at the pump, how much do you expect that will continue on further into 2024? When do we hit the peak?
Well, if history is a guide, we usually hit a peak anywhere in the next 4 to 8 weeks. Depends on refinery maintenance, but utilization numbers have been showing some improvement. That is, refineries finishing their seasonal maintenance, getting back online. Eventually, that will contribute to gasoline supplies going up, and that should help put downward pressure on the pump. But that could take a little while to get here, and there still could be some refinery issues that could prolong maintenance. But here and now, I think we're getting close to a top, but keep in mind the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast still have to make the final step over to summer gasoline. And with it, a jump of anywhere from 15 to 40 cents a gallon is going to be coming in those areas in the next few weeks.
Well, you talk about the Mid-Atlantic, Patrick, and specifically when we think about the Mid-Atlantic, things have perhaps changed over the last week in that the Port of Baltimore and a lot of flow around that area have been affected by the collapse of the Key Bridge. Do you expect that that actually is going to have an impact on energy prices, or is that really just hyper-local?
Yeah, it certainly is hyper-local. There are a few terminals in the Baltimore area, but gasoline is continuing to flow thanks to the Colonial Pipeline, which basically goes right through the backyard of where the bridge collapse occurred. Now, the Port of Baltimore being closed then for movements of things like ethanol and refined products, but it's not typically a big port when it comes to some of those. So thankfully, there is a pipeline here. Ethanol could be a little bit of a challenge, but with the Coast Guard and Army Corps of Engineers starting to move on potential reopening part of the port, I think that's very good news. But the bottom line here is that the Port of Baltimore is not going to have an impact on what we see nationally. Now, getting into some of those talks, obviously later this year, there have been some talks about hurricane season being busier than normal. It's going to be a big wild card going into August and September, just a couple of months before the election. If we do see a major hurricane, that could disrupt refineries and send gas prices temporarily higher.
And all of that, of course, is on the supply side, right? You have less supply, but the same amount of demand. That's what pushes prices upward. But it does raise the question around demand as well, Patrick. We know that there is a relationship between gas prices and consumer sentiment. They see higher prices. Consumers maybe feel not as good about the economy, or their inflation expectations move higher. But also, if they're feeling good about the economy and demanding more gasoline, spending more at the pump, or at least, you know, continuing those activity, that also can drive prices higher. How do you think about that relationship when it comes to demand?
Well, I mean, as you mentioned, the Fed has a very interesting conversation about, you know, when they start to lower interest rates. I think that could be a negative on gasoline demand. If Americans start to see some of the numbers improving, well, it may cause them to go out and say, well, hey, I've got this extra money, the cost of borrowing is improving, so maybe I'll take a trip, or maybe I'll fill the improvement in interest rates with some sort of increase in demand. So I think that is the risk here, is how quickly the economy starts to fire back up on even more cylinders if interest rates start to come down. But looking at things now, that's where the EV transition also comes into view. Now, the EV transition has been happening, but it's been slowing down, less Americans showing an appetite for ditching their internal combustion engine vehicles. But all in all, 2024 summer gasoline demand will be nowhere near what we saw in 2019 prior to the pandemic. There's still the additional flexibility of working from home, and still a lot of Americans who are feeling that gas prices as they drive to work, seeing those prices, are prohibiting them from going out on a summer road trip and traveling.
Well, you mentioned the EV question. Of course, it was just a few weeks ago that the EPA formally rolled out its new emission standards, looking out to 2032 here. But the idea is there's going to be a larger representation of hybrid or at least all electric vehicles for climate related purposes. That has gotten a good deal of pushback from more conservative conservatives here in Washington. Of course, all of it playing a factor probably in the election in November. Patrick, I know it's very hard to difficult to forecast these energy markets even a month out, let alone 7 months out. But come November, where do you think we will be in terms of prices at the pump? Do you expect they will be higher or lower than they are now?
I think there's going to be a lot of conspiracy theories. In fact, I'm seeing a lot of them now. But gas prices almost always, I can't think of a year as an exception, go down into the cooler months. And that's simply because Americans drive more in the summer. They drive less in the fall and winter, especially, you know, those fall foliage tours or whatnot. I think after that, as we get into early November, there's less reason for Americans to be out on the road, barring Thanksgiving. But that is going to push gas prices lower starting in mid to late September. Again, hurricane season could be a major wild card, but I would forecast to see possibly tens of thousands of stations seeing prices back below $3 a gallon just in time for the election. And the two are not connected. This is simply gas prices go up in the spring, and they fall in the fall.
Well, of course, we have seen a lot of connection between gas prices and potentially President Biden's approval rating when it comes to the economy. We have seen under the course of his administration him try to take action to fix that, including tapping the Strategic Petroleum Reserve in order to keep a lid, if you will, on prices. Do you expect at any point over the next year that that will be necessary again?
I can't think of any sort of action that would require the SPR. Although if you would have asked me, you know, 5 months before Russia's invasion of Ukraine, I wouldn't have thought it would have been necessary as well. But when you see oil prices suddenly jump $50 to $60 a barrel this time because of Russia's invasion, that's really what the SPR, the definition of a strategic reserve is because there's a huge economic consequence to jolting gas prices up, which follow oil. So I think in this case, Americans obviously don't like high gas prices. What they don't like even more is when they suddenly jump 50 cents to 80 cents. So I don't think the administration is going to tap the SPR. I don't really see any action that would necessitate it. But having said that, there's still tensions in the Middle East that are flaring up, and that could become a destabilizing factor later this year.
Yeah, obviously, there's a lot going on around the world to keep an eye on. Just in our final seconds here with you, Patrick, in terms of what's going on around the country, where's the most expensive place and then the cheapest place to buy gas right now?
Well, the most expensive, if you're headed into California, the average there back over $5 a gallon. Some stations, as you'll find on social media, closer to $7 in some areas of California. The average is $5. On the other side of that, going down to areas like Mississippi, Oklahoma, and Texas, you'll find some areas where most communities are still seeing gasoline below $3 a gallon.
All right, Patrick DeHaan of Gas Buddy, thank you so much, as always, for joining us here.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Worth noting that before this week is out, we will mark 6 months since October 7th in the Hamas attacks against Israelis and, of course, the resulting war between Israel and Hamas, which is still ongoing as we speak. And, of course, Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was the one speaking yesterday, held a news conference in which he talked about a plan to prepare to move more than a million Palestinians out of Rafah, that southern Gaza city, and then carry out an attack against the remaining Hamas battalions there. This is, there is ongoing pressure, both internationally and potentially domestically as well, for a ceasefire deal with Hamas, as tens of thousands of Israelis were protesting over this weekend as well, calling for a new government. We want to break it all down now with Nick Wadhams, who leads our U.S. national security coverage here in Washington. He is joining me in studio. So, Nick, first of all, great to see you. Happy Monday. As we heard from Netanyahu over the weekend, talking about how they're going to move more than a million people out of Rafah. Can they realistically do that? How hard is that going to be?
I mean, that is the great question, and that's what the administration has really been pushing, because Prime Minister Netanyahu has said for many weeks, you know, they intend to do this. The U.S. has been pressing and saying, listen, you don't need to do this kind of military campaign. We would rather see a campaign that relies on precision strikes targeting the leaders of Hamas, but a full-scale campaign like that, don't do it. If you do it, you need to give us a credible plan for what you're going to do with all these civilians who have fled to Rafah from the north. And so far, the administration says, you know, they just have not seen any sort of plan. I mean, a million people is a lot of people to move. You're going to have to house them. You're going to have to feed them, provide medical care. Where do they go? They can't go back to northern Gaza. So do they go somewhere else? Egypt, is there going to be a I mean, there's so many questions around this. And so far, I mean, this is a tension point between the U.S. and Israel that we just have not seen resolved for several weeks.
Well, speaking of tension between the U.S. and Israel, or perhaps more specifically between Benjamin Netanyahu and President Biden, we heard from Senator Chris Van Hollen, the Democrat from Maryland, speaking on one of the Sunday shows this weekend, who said Netanyahu, this is a quote, continues to essentially give the finger to the President of the United States, and we're sending more bombs.
Right.
Are we going to keep sending bombs in the face of the finger, Nick?
Well, I mean, Chris Van Hollen has been one of the most outspoken U.S. senators on this issue, and he is pushing this idea of conditioning more military aid on humanitarian improvements from the Netanyahu administration. So this is not out of character for him. So far, though, no. The answer is the Biden administration has made clear that they are going to support Israel through thick and thin. There may be some effort on the margins or a broader diplomatic effort to try to shape this campaign, but I very strongly believe you are not going to see a situation where the U.S. suspends military aid along the lines of what Chris Van Hollen would want. I mean, that just the blowback would be so fierce, and it goes against everything we know about how President Biden sees this relationship.
So maybe there's limits to the pressure the U.S. realistically can apply on Netanyahu's government for that reason. But it raises the question of what domestic pressure Netanyahu may face, though that maybe he's a bit more beholden to. Over the weekend, tens of thousands of people out calling for a new government, something, mind you, which the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer himself called for just a few weeks ago. What does this do to Netanyahu's position and potentially his conduct moving forward throughout this conflict?
Well, I mean, these sort of protests are not necessarily a new thing. You saw a lot of this around the judicial reforms that his administration wanted to push through, and it took a long time for his administration to budge. The central tension there is, yes, you may have thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people on the streets in Israel, but his cabinet is so right-wing, and the pressures he's getting internally are moving in exactly the opposite direction. Drive a harder bargain, be harder against the Palestinians, hit them harder. So he's going to have to balance those two things, but you know, the issue is the right-wing colleagues he has in the cabinet would be a much more imminent threat to his grip on power if he decided to reverse course. I mean, he would be gone in minutes. Whereas these protests, it looks like a big deal, but that's something he could reasonably withstand for quite some time. So you're really going to see a challenge in how he navigates on that. But the judicial reforms are a great example. It took a very, very long time for him to make any sort of movement on that. So I wouldn't expect to see anything happen really quickly here.
Okay, so that's the spot that the Israeli leader is in at this time. I want to talk, though, about another leader in the Middle East, the president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. There were municipal elections over the weekend, pretty unprecedented defeat, where the opposition party actually gained ground in a number of areas that have been a stronghold for his governing party. What's happening in Turkey mean for broadly the conditions in the Middle East?
You know, it's a great question because I think the issue with Erdogan is that he doesn't actually face any real challenge to his own power until 2028 when he would come up for re-election. So it's a blow, but is this going to shape or put pressure on him internationally in terms of his position to work as a power broker, his position in NATO, sometimes as an irritant? I mean, he is just sort of getting things back on track with the U.S. and NATO. They abandoned their blockage of Sweden's accession to NATO. So, you know, this is someone who the U.S. and others, they may have their problems with him, but they feel that this is a relationship that can be managed. This sort of domestic pressure, I think, it's a big deal for him in terms of what's going to happen long term, but it's very long term. I mean, he doesn't face any real threat to his legitimacy until 2028. So certainly a foreboding, a warning shot, but he's also had shown a great tendency in the past to be able to use the powers of the presidency to sideline his opponents. Mm-hmm. So he's got a lot of time to sort of pivot and figure out how to address this before he faces any real challenge to his power in a few years.
All right, Nick Wadhams, who leads our national security coverage here in Washington. Thank you.
Thank you
so much. Nick, of course, running us through domestic pressures that the Turkish president is facing, the Israeli prime minister is facing. Now let's talk about the domestic pressures that the president of the United States is facing as he, of course, campaigns for re-election. And there is a great deal, if you look at the primary vote, of those who are potentially not satisfied with his handling of the war between Israel and Hamas, and that has shown up in people voting uncommitted in Democratic primaries. On this subject, we want to turn now to Pat Dennis. He is the president of American Bridge 21st Century. Pat, thank you so much for joining us here on Balance of Power. We know that there is some dissatisfaction with a primary electorate in places like Michigan, for example, where there is a heavy Arab and Muslim population, as is with young people as well, with the way that the president has handled this conflict. What does he need to change moving forward in order to make sure those people actually are willing to vote for him in November?
Hey, Kaylee, it's great to be back. So these issues are some of the most difficult issues in American politics. And ultimately, you know, I think what people want in a president is a steady hand on the tiller, somebody who's reasonable, somebody who can take, you know, these problems, you know, deal with them as they change, and, you know, somebody that you can trust in there and not be freaked out all the time, which I think is in real contrast to Donald Trump's just like completely erratic leadership on foreign policy, but really on everything. But also the current chaos in the House of Representatives, I think, is also an incredible contrast to just how can we govern with these people? You know, how can we govern globally with folks who can't even govern their caucus? So, you know, we have challenges inside the government. We have challenges with, you know, some of the hardest geopolitical challenges that presidents face. But ultimately, you know, it is an issue of doing the work, showing up, and being a steady hand as opposed to the erratic stuff we're getting from the Republicans.
But when it comes to this issue in particular of what's happening in Gaza, the loss of Palestinian life, we have seen this resonating specifically with young voters, Pat, a demographic that the president is going to need to hold on to if he has any hopes of winning a second term. Do you think with young voters in particular that this issue is paramount, or is it something else like the economy, for example?
It's an important issue, but when you're president of the entire country and everything that's going on. This is an extremely important issue. The economy is an important issue. Student loans are an important issue. All of these things are extremely important. The contrast here is, again, you know, with somebody like Donald Trump, whose leadership and statements on these things are frankly frequently very disgusting and I think scare people a lot. So you've seen Donald Trump almost deliberately jettison whole portions of the Republican Party, saying he doesn't need Nikki Haley supporters. He doesn't need anybody who isn't automatically loyal to him. And I think that right there is absolutely the wrong strategy to get elected president. But that's what you see Donald Trump doing, as opposed with Joe Biden, who is, you know, working to make the country better.
Well, you raise former President Trump. Of course, there was some news over the weekend, or at least a dialogue over the weekend, about something that Trump had reposted on Truth Social. It was a video of basically traffic that included a pickup truck, which emblazoned on the back of the truck was an image of the president, President Biden, hogtied, laying on his side in the bed. Of course, the Biden campaign was very quick to seize on that, talking about how this was essentially another example of Trump encouraging political violence, whereas the Trump campaign alluded to the fact that Democrats are making a very big deal of this at the same time that they're weaponizing the Justice Department, in their words, against him. Should the Biden campaign be reacting to each and everything that we see from President Trump on social media or everything he says in a press conference, or is it best to let some things go? What should the strategy be here in dealing with who you're going to be up against in the general election?
Well, this is the dilemma, right? You either let it go, and then what does he do? He pushes it further. Or, you know, you call it out every time, and then you're playing on his playing field. Honestly, the real answer here is that Donald Trump oversaw political violence against the United States of America. Like, this is who the guy is. This is what he's done. It's what he's going to do. And that is a very important part of the message overall. So look, he's not taking us off message by promoting political violence. That is something that people need to know about, something they need to remember, that this is a guy. We had a long history of peaceful transitions of power in this country until Donald Trump came into office. So this is, we got to talk about it. You can't just let this stuff go. If you do let it go, he'll take it further. And who knows, you know, people could get hurt.
Well, Pat, and we know President Biden has put a lot of focus into contrasting himself with President Trump, be it for questions around political violence or the state of democracy. But theoretically, he could also need to contrast himself with others, including RFK Jr., for example, potentially a no labels ticket if we ever get the announcement of who actually is going to be on it. Does more effort need to go into acknowledging those potential third party threats and trying to counter them?
Yeah, well, at my organization, American Bridge 21st Century, a big part of what we do is opposition research on candidates. And somebody like RFK, it's actually kind of interesting. The less people know about him, the better he does. If they just know the last name Kennedy, they go, oh, you know, maybe this is kind of a reasonable guy. But the second they learn about his positions, you know, his also flirting with political violence, he's flirted with a 15-week abortion ban, obviously his extreme anti-vaccine rhetoric, all these things, the second people learn about them, especially people who might otherwise be considering voting for Biden, they're like, I'm out of here. You know, I'm not voting for this guy. So our job is really just to communicate. And there's no world where RFK runs for president without anybody learning about him. So we're happy to be here to tell the world. And no labels, look, we would be doing the same if they could figure out how to find a candidate. And if they do, I'll probably be saying the same thing.
Pat, we only have about a minute left, but we know that President Biden has a great deal of cash at his disposal. He raised more than $25 million in one night last week alongside former Presidents Biden and Clinton, more than $100 million on hand. Should some of that be spent specifically on countering or at least providing information on RFK or others rather than just on going after Trump?
Well, my organization, we're a super PAC, we're separate from Joe Biden's spending, but we've announced a $200 million effort to communicate with swing voters. Part of that is the RFK stuff. So it's definitely something that we're focusing on. Mm-hmm. I'm sure Joe Biden is aware that this is also a priority, but this is the kind of thing where you can run ahead of Donald Trump on money, and we're happy to do so, but ultimately, we're going to act like we're behind every single day until Election Day and not take a single vote for granted.
All right, Pat Dennis, always great to have you here on Balance of Power. Thank you so much for your time. Pat Dennis, of course, is the president over at American Bridge 21st Century.
Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.